Okay, so welcome to seminar number two on writing the history of the First World War. We're still looking at different sorts of sources, and quite often a good historian is somebody who finds new sources, sources that nobody thought of analysing before. And this one here that we're looking at, a slightly special sort of resource, because this is literary works written during the war. Now, of course, literature is literature and history is history, but obviously if a literary work is written during the war to please a particular audience, yeah, perhaps a working class audience, perhaps a middle class audience, then this will tell us something about the history of representations, or the history of mentalities, or the history of feelings, some sides of it in any case. And here we have three examples. This is a book by H.G. Wells. Now, H.G. Wells, for a reason which I don't completely understand, has a reputation as a pacifist, whereas in fact he wanted Britain to win the war, but you know, he maintained his reputation as a pacifist. And this is a novel, an excellent novel, which he wrote during the war. Now, H.G. Wells wrote many, very many famous novels. Can you name any of H.G. Wells's books? The War of the Worlds, oui, la guerre des mondes, je pense que c'est célèbre quand même, non? Yeah. The Invisible Man. Another one, can anybody name another one?
The Time Machine.
The Time Machine. Yeah, these are very famous. They were books before they were films, yes. H.G. Wells, very major, not popular novelist of the end. But he wrote this one during the war, and it's a very, very interesting novel. It was very popular during the war, and it's quite balanced in a way. So it's about a middle-class family in Britain and what happens to them in the war. But also, they find it very difficult because they always had a lot of German friends, for example. Yeah, and there's a lot of debate going on within the family. This is a play by Bernard Shaw, George Bernard Shaw. Now, George Bernard Shaw was one of the greatest playwrights of the time. At the time, remember that cinema is only silence, and of course, no television or radio. So theatre was far more important than it is today. And very often, theatre could be quite political. And George Bernard Shaw was a very adventurous playwright. He wrote plays about the question of prostitution. He wrote plays about the question of women's suffrage. And he wrote plays about the war. So this is a source which would tell us something about, you know, the kind of attitudes among theatre-goers during the war. The interesting thing about this is that these are not plays by the war. They are playlets. They are short plays. And this was because he wanted plays which could be played in the music hall, not in a theatre. The theatre is really, really for the middle class. The music hall is for the working class. But quite often a music hall evening, which would be a song, then an acrobat, then a song, then a ventriloquist, then a short play by Bernard Shaw. 15, 20 minute play. This was new because before the war, theatre playwrights would not write for the music hall, because we are theatre playwrights, we are important people, and the music hall is like a bit like the circus, you know. Below them. But because of the patriotic atmosphere during the war, the very famous writers like George Bernard Shaw and the person whose name I always forget who wrote Peter Pan. Who wrote Peter Pan? I can't remember. Yeah, but you've heard of Peter Pan. Yes. James Bond. James Barry, thank you. James Barry, thank you. Special point for him. Yeah, James Bond, no. James Barry, yes. Wrote Peter, and they wrote for the musical plays about the war. So it's an interesting idea there. So certainly, I think that if you wrote a history book about people, in fact, Andrew Maunder wrote a history book about theatre during the war, and you could find out things about, you know, what kind of plays were being written and why, and how they were received, and what did the newspapers say about them, and you would find out something about how literary and the imaginary world were reacting to a very new situation. There's your source then, literature during the war. And finally then, the war poems, the poems in this case of Siegfried Sassoon. the war poems were sometimes already popular during the war, but since the war they have become extremely popular. In fact, the most popular poems in Britain today are those which were written during the First World War. When they have a national newspaper survey, you know, what is your favourite poem? Every time the First World War poems are right up there in Britain. So something very British about that. I don't know what would be the most popular poems in France if you did it. It would be, you know, Autant suspend ton vol, the ones that people remember from school, I think, you know. I won't do that particular. So literary works written during the war are an obvious source. And here you get two books which are written about them. These are history books, these are not... So on the left then, Touch and Intimacy in First World War Literature. This is Santanu Das, a great historian. So he's looking at literature from the First World War and how did they treat these questions of touch and intimacy. Remember that the world at the time, and in particular Britain, have a very different attitude to touch and intimacy than they do today. One of the reasons that dance was so important in the 1920s was that in general men and women, young men and young women, were not supposed to talk to each other and certainly not to touch each other. They had very little privacy. You lived here in this house, and next door lives your auntie, and across there lives your grandma, and everybody knows each other. And if you have a boyfriend, you know, it's really difficult to find any secret. You have to have any secret at all. So normally it would be, you go and sit in his house, and then he goes and sits in your house, and you do this four times, and then he has to marry you. Okay. Rather rigid. Yeah, so this one here then on women's writings on the First World War, about the literature side then. If we look at the poems, we can find out something about the poems. Some of them are tremendous. I'm going to quote you a couple of the most famous ones. This one is by Rupert Brooke. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by sons of home. So, quite a sophisticated poem poetically, but a patriotic poem. Yeah? If I die in France, part of the earth will be richer than the rest of it because I'm English. It's a very, very traditional sort of patriotic way of looking. Tremendously popular. This was published towards the beginning of the war. In fact, it was published in this collection called Muse in Arms, published in 1917. If you were studying the First World War poems, you can study the content, but also how they were received, who published them, who read them, you know, all these questions, which are questions of society. And so here we have some information, that this was published in November 17 and February 18, and look at what they said in the introduction. A collection of war poems, for the most part written in the field of action by seamen, soldiers and flying men who are serving or have served in the Great War. It's a very, very important document, very, very important paragraph that, because a lot of people were thinking, oh, poems. Yeah, our men are out fighting in the battles and dying and you're writing poems? Yeah, so it would be, and so this is, no. These poems are written by men who have done their duty. It's a very defensive introduction, and it shows something very important about the atmosphere. So the problem is, again, I think I already mentioned this question, the problem is knowing the grammar of the source. That is the structure of publishing, what it means to publish and to defend your publishing, and so on at this time. And a whole series of, this was the other poems in the same collection as this famous one, and you see some of them, you know, patriotic, the motherland, the Christian soldier. Sometimes the poems which are not famous and not very good are just as interesting. You can learn a lot from the bad poems that were written during the war. Yeah. This is the difference between the literature researcher and the historian. Historians, we like good poems, we like bad poems, because you can learn from them. Whereas generally literature likes to study the good poems, you know, the ones which are a bit sophisticated, have something in them, yeah? And certainly the Christian Soldier will be interesting because this was a tremendous debate at the time. Well, we have to go and kill Germans, but we're Christians, and the Germans are Christians. How can we sort this out? And I will come back to that a little later on. But first of all, another poem. This is one of the most famous poems in the English language, and it's just an extract from it. I don't know, have you seen this before? This is a sonnet, although you're only getting part of it here, by Wilfred Owen. And it talks about a moment when the gas, they were attacked by gas. Gas, gas. Quick, boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fixing the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil's, sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie, duce et decorum est pro patria mori. So the last line is a slogan in Latin, which means it is sweet and fitting to die for your country. So this is a very clearly an anti-war song, because it says those people who say it is good to die for your country are liars. They have never seen what we have seen. Yes, so it's an anti-war song, and tremendously popular song. Although it's interesting that people who do not love Wilfred Owen hate Wilfred Owen. It's a very controversial poem. More sources then, which would be, because I mentioned there literature written at the time, and so the obvious next source is literature written later. And probably the most famous is Investinich Neues, Eric Remarque. Anybody know the title in French? A l'Ouest rien de nouveau. So this is a novel, but based on the war experience of Remarque. In fact, 3 days ago I was in the Remarque Museum. They have a museum for him. Incredible writer. And this was important because this was published, I think, in 1929, and it was translated into many, many languages and went around the world very, very quickly, extremely popular, very, very quickly. A big shock to the entire world, and then was made into a film a little later on, A l'Ouest rien de nouveau. And so this kind of source, you could learn. Here is where you're going into the history of representations. That is to say, what you could learn, supposing you found 10 novels published in 1928 about the First World War, what you would be looking at is, what did the First World War mean at the end of the 1920s? Which is different from what does the First World War mean today? This is the history of representations. How a historical events like the French Revolution or the First World War changes its meaning with different generations. And one of the biggest changes is that after the Second World War, the First World War did not have the same meaning as it had before the Second World War. Because of course, before the Second World War, it was not the First World War. It was the Great War. Because it had been terrible, but it was the last time. It had been the war to end war, but you know, it was a terrible thing, but it's the last time. This will never happen again. And that's the meaning which it had in 1929, 1930, 1931. But of course, later on, that became much more, sophisticated. 1929, much more recent, Birdsong, the novel of Loving War. Anybody know this novel? It sold quite a lot. Came out just a few years ago. No, not a few years ago. A long time ago. That's what it's like being old. Literature written later. Other forms of artistic production are also involved, of course. paintings at the time. This is an extremely famous painting by Thingy, Gertler, Mark Gertler, I think. And it's called Merry-Go-Round. Yeah, the fairground. And in fact, some of the people are in military uniforms, and they are all looking very robotic and tense, and they're going round and round and round and not enjoying themselves, but nobody can stop it. And the general interpretation at the time is that the merry-go-round, what is continuing which cannot stop, is the war. That's the idea. Yeah? So quite a powerful thing. Yes, of course, when you're a painter, you have to think about symbolism. Of course, you can paint a picture of a soldier with his head knocked off by a bomb, something really gory, of course, and that's one way of doing war. But there are also many, many other ways of presenting it. And this is an example. Yeah, Mark Gertler, I got it right, 1916. But as well as the, here you have, so this is quite a modern artist trying to attack the war in a symbolic way. But you also had official war artists. That is that every army, the French army and the British army, found an artist. We want an official war artist. Will you go to the battles and paint pictures, please? We want an official war artist. Well, this is fascinating, I think. It doesn't really matter if you like the picture or you don't like the picture. That's not the problem. The problem is, why did the armies feel it was necessary to have an official war artist? There's some interesting questions there. I suspect that having an official war artist is about showing that our country wants to win the war, but also we represent a humanist, artistic, creative view of humanity. It's a form of legitimacy, that we're not just spending money on getting better tanks, we're also spending money on having an artistic way of treating reality and reinterpreting and understanding reality. And I thought, very interesting, official war artists, I think that would be a very good history book to write. There isn't one. Official war artists of the First World War. Because there's something about being, well, there's something bizarre about being an official artist in a way, isn't there? Because normally we think of an artist as somebody who expresses their personality and what they personally do. But of course this is quite modern, because if you go back 500 years, you were an artist because the king paid you to paint pictures, yeah? Otherwise you had nothing to eat, yeah? And the invention of the independent artist in the middle of the beginning of the 19th century is something new in art. So there's all those sorts of things going on. There you go, that's Battle of Courcelette. An official war artist. We're getting close to the end of the sources, but we haven't quite finished. Cinema at the time. Now, of course, cinema was silent at the time. Did I already mention this? When you go to see a film in 1914, what can you hear? Yeah, the piano. Maybe I mentioned this last week. There's always a piano. So it's not really silent, because, you know, who wants to watch a film in silence? There's always a piano. This was a fascinating film produced, The Battle of the Somme. Here's an extract from it. Some of it was staged, yeah? They told the soldiers what to do. But also they showed pictures of dead British soldiers. This was a bestseller. Every cinema was full. Remember, they had never seen war on the screen. Nobody had ever seen war on the screen. Whereas we see too much war on the screen every day, you know. No, they had no video games. What a terrible life they must have had without video games, don't you think? Never mind. So it made a huge amount of money. And there has been some good work done on this. It's a wonderful history book, British Silent Cinema and the Great War. How they dealt with it. And one of the things they did is that they analysed the music that went with the scenes. Because in 1914 to 1918, the company that produced the film, they sent the film to the cinemas with a list of pieces of music which were recommended for the different scenes. But these lists have usually been lost. And they found some of them, it's very, very interesting, because in fact they're quite sort of cheerful thing, you know, diddly-dee, and when there's just people being filmed killing each other and stuff, and it's really gay stuff, it was bizarre. Cinema of the time is a source. Now here's another source which you would be a little bit more surprised at. I mean, I'm hoping that some of the sources have already surprised you, but this is one. What on earth is that? What is the source here? I'm not going to make you guess, because I don't think you will. Anybody want to try? Archaeological finds. You see, we always think of archaeology as, oh yeah, ancient Rome, yeah, the Middle Ages maybe. But archaeology can be much more recent. And in the trenches, in the battlefields, they now do archaeological work and they find objects. Now, they don't look very exciting as you see them there, but for example, they find a lot of objects which were made by the soldiers just to amuse themselves. And you can get a certain amount of information from that. How many religious objects do you get on a battlefield? I don't know, but it would be interesting to find out. Archaeological finds, and there's the history book that goes with it. Archaeology and the First World War by Nicholas Saunders. You can see that although there are a huge number of books on the First World War, they're not all writing about the same thing. Yeah, they're going for their particular approach, choosing sources, choosing questions. And of course, afterwards you get to the question, which are the most interesting questions? Well, it's a matter of opinion. Yeah, some questions you like. But I would say that in general, the most interesting questions begin with why. That is, that the purely descriptive questions, yeah, how did they do this, are not as interesting as why it happened. Another wonderful source here, that somebody discovered this, somebody came up with this idea that they decided to do a history book about this, that nobody had thought of using this source before. This is also a history of representations, that is to say, what did the First World War mean to people after the war at different moments. Very, very simple. There are thousands of them in France. And then one day, somebody decided to study them. Monuments. In the 1920s, many, many thousands of monuments were created in France and in Britain as well. And here's one of them. This one, in fact, this is a photograph I took myself. It's in Glasgow. To the everlasting honour and glory. It's not in Glasgow, is it? It's in York. Of the 8,814 officers, non-commissioned officers, and men of the York and Lancaster Regiment who fell in the Great War. Now, of course, if you have one monument, you haven't learnt very much. But if you have 1,000 monuments, how many of them use words like glory and honour? Yeah, how many are glorious? How many are tragic? What kind of images do they use? Do they use military, aggressive imagery? We won, victory. Or is it more sad? This looks like something more sad, doesn't it? In fact, I think you don't have the soldier, you just have his equipment. There are huge, huge numbers of these. Another one there. One of the things they discovered when they wrote a book about monuments in Britain is that when the monument was produced in small towns, for example, the people who decided what monument and what it would look like were not the soldiers or the families of the dead and so on. It was, in every case, it seemed to be the local elite, the mayor and his friends, who decided what was it. So there was a whole history to write about how were all the, because all the discussions about what kind of monument do we need say a lot about people's ideas. Yeah, and so that was very interesting. The most famous of the First World War monuments is this one. This is in London. It's the Cenotaph. The Glorious Dead, only three words. This is very minimalist, yeah? Not like, I was in Germany and they have monuments with like 58 sentences on them, huge amounts of text, like the Americans do as well. If you go to the Washington, the monuments for the different ones. And here's a quote from Shakespeare and here's a quote from Milton, yeah? It's very simple, The Glorious Dead. But the most important thing about this monument, absolutely very, very surprising thing about this monument, and I'm wondering if somebody can find it, and this is what is not present. A tremendously important question for historians, because what is not present is often extremely important. although obviously more difficult to find because it's not there. This is a monument in 1919 to almost a million dead of the British Empire, but something is kind of missing that you would expect to be there, but it's not there. Let me help you. There is no religious symbolism. Now, today, in 2018, if you have a monument with no religious symbolism, that's not surprising. You know, we do lots of them. In 1919, that is absolutely stunning, absolutely amazing that they should have no religious. It's a very, very religious country. The British soldiers had obligatory church every Sunday when they were in France. And for some reason, which I don't know because I haven't studied it, but for some, in my opinion, interesting reason, there is no religious symbols here. This is not because they wanted to be respectful to the Muslims and the Jews. I don't think they cared about that. They were mostly Christians, and for some reason they didn't have it, yeah? The other thing about this is how improvised it was. The initial version was in wood because it was planned as a temporary monument. So let's have a temporary monument for a few years. It was extremely popular. I don't mean that people were happy about it, but people expressed tremendous appreciation that there was a monument in London, in the centre of London, to the dead, and there was a massive demand that it should be a permanent monument. So all of this, there are two sides of this. First of all, we have history of representations. How was the war represented in monuments? And there's also a sort of social psychology side of it. What do monuments mean to people? Now, of course, quite often we just walk past monuments. There are monuments everywhere in Rouen. We just walk past and we don't even think. But sometimes the monuments are very important to people. Why? What do they do? And all sorts of things about mourning. How does mourning work? There's been a big something very new in the last 20 years in France and in other countries as well, is when there is a tragic death, you have the marche blanche. Vous en avez entendu parler dans les infos, il y a une marche blanche pour telle ou telle personne qui a été, en France surtout, qui a été assassinée. This is a completely new invention. It's about 20 years old. As you can imagine, 100 years ago, they could have a religious thing because everybody was kind of a bit religious. And you get these new inventions. And the monuments were a new invention. You don't get a lot of monuments in every town about the wars in 1850 or 1870 or 1880. But the First World War was a massive change in monumentization. And a couple of them are tremendously interesting. This one is somewhere near Paris, and it's a very exceptional one because it says, Maudite soit la guerre. So it doesn't say, to the glory of our children who died for the fatherland. It says, Maudite soit la guerre. This is very unusual. There are two or three anti-war monuments from the 1920s. They're very old. So it was a decision by the local commune. So they've got all the names of the people who died. Nos chers enfants, maudite soit la guerre. And this is, I think this is a child showing the adults. You were a bit stupid, weren't you? Yeah. It's a very, very symbolic one. There are many, many more monuments. You can go on forever, in fact, monuments. We're talking about history of representation, which in a way is not about the First World War, it's about later periods. Strangely enough, there is a large number of new monuments produced these last 10 years about the First World War. Well, this is kind of surprising because you know, the year after a war, you create a monument. But 100 years later, you're still creating new monuments. So, now obviously, they must have something new. Yeah, you can't go to your town, you know, in Sotteville, and say, ah oui, vous voyez le monument aux morts de la Grande Guerre? Je voudrais en faire un autre pour les morts de la Grande Guerre à côté. No, we've already got one. So if you're building a new monument, it's for a new reason. And I'm going to just show you a couple of the new monuments. Because some people had new reasons today to build monuments about the First World War. Surprisingly, it's about sound. Here's a close-up of one of them. What has he got over his eyes? What has he got on his eyes? Well, it's a blindfold to stop him seeing. Why has he got a blindfold? Do you think? Oh, he's playing a game. No, he's not playing a game. Anybody got an idea why you put on a blindfold when you're in the army? It's generally bad news. Yeah. If your sergeant says, oh, just come here, put this blindfold on, it's not good. No, what's going to happen to him?
Executed.
Yeah, he's going to be executed. This is a monument to the British soldiers executed by their own army, by the British army, during the First World War. And it's a new monument, I think it's 10 years old. So this is very interesting. Yeah, so these are commemorations of groups of people who previously the establishment did not want to commemorate. They were cowards. They ran away or they fell asleep on the job and they were executed. And I will say more about this in a moment. But that's been interesting. Second, new monuments. What are these two soldiers doing? They're going to shake hands. Are they both from the same country? No, they're not. You can tell by the helmet. This is a German. So this is a monument. And in fact, it's a monument to the Christmas truce. You probably heard about this, where for a short time in Christmas 1914, because it was Christmas, the soldiers decided not to fight. And so this is a monument. Where is it? Where is it placed? It's in my flat. This is my flat. No, it's not my flat. Where is it? It's in a church. So when you're studying monuments, where they are is tremendously important. If it's in a military building or in a religious building and so on. So this is part of the grammar of sources, again. So this is a new monument, very recent monument, in a cathedral, in fact, somewhere in Britain. I saw recently a plaque, in fact, in a church in Oxford, in memory of the Catholics and the Protestants who were killed during the Reformation. That is in the 16th and 17th century. Now, this was surprising because usually you see in the Catholic Church, you see, in honour of the Catholics who were killed by the Protestants in the Reformation, in the Protestant Church you have the opposite, yeah? But this, there was a plaque to the both of them together, and this plaque, this monument, if you like, was placed there in 2005. So a little bit after the 17th century. So there are processes of monumentalisation. To be gone on. That's another one. I can't actually remember what this one is for, but that's another monument of. I was there in November 2014, but I can't remember why. That's all I have to say about sources, and I'm kind of hoping that in that way you've sort of seen that there are more kinds of sources than you thought there might be. We're going to have exactly 5 minutes break.